Celeritas frowned at the request, made the next morning, and looked at Lawrence narrowly.
"You wish to go with Captain Rankin? Well, it will be the last day of liberty you have for a long time, for you must and will be here for every moment of Temeraire's flight training."
He was almost fierce about it, and Lawrence was surprised by his vehemence. "I assure you I have no objection," he said, wondering in astonishment if the training master thought he meant to shirk his duties. "Indeed, I had not imagined otherwise, and I am well aware of the need for urgency in his training. If my absence would cause any difficulty, I beg you to have no hesitation in refusing the request." Whatever the source of his initial disapproval, Celeritas was mollified by this statement.
"As it happens, the ground crewmen will need a day to fit Temeraire out with his new gear, and it will be ready by then," he said in less stern tones. "I suppose we can spare you, as long as Temeraire is not finicky about being harnessed without you there, and you may as well have a final excursion."
Temeraire assured Lawrence he did not mind, so the plan was settled, and Lawrence spent part of the next few evenings making measurements of his neck and of Maximus's, thinking the regal copper's current size might be a good approximation for what Temeraire could reach in future. He pretended to Temeraire that these were for the harness. He looked forward to giving the present as a surprise, and seeing it take away some of the quiet distress that lingered, casting a pall over the dragon's usually high spirits. Rankin looked with amusement at his sketches of possible designs. The two of them had already formed the settled habit of playing chess together in the evenings and sitting together at dinner. Lawrence so far had little conversation with the other aviators. He regretted it, but could see little point in trying to push himself forward when he was comfortable enough as he was, and in the absence of any sort of invitation. It seemed clear to him that Rankin was as outside the common life of the aviators as he was, perhaps set aside by the elegance of his manners, and if they were both outcast for the same reason, they might at least have the pleasure of each other's society for compensation. He and Berkeley met at breakfast and training every day, and he continued to find the other captain an astute airman and aerial tactician, but at dinner or in company, Berkeley was silent. Lawrence was not sure either that he wished to draw the man into intimacy, or that a gesture in that direction would be welcome, so he contented himself with being civil and discussing technical matters. So far they had known each other only a few days, and there would be time enough to take a better measure of the man's real character. He had steeled himself to react properly on meeting Captain Harcourt again, but she seemed shy of his company. He saw her almost only at a distance, though Temeraire was soon to be flying in company with her dragon, Lily. One morning, however, she was at table when he arrived for breakfast, and in an attempt to make natural conversation, he asked how her dragon came to be called Lily, thinking it might be a nickname like Volley's. She flushed to her roots again and said very stiffly, "I liked the name. Pray, how did you come to name Temeraire?"
"To be perfectly honest, I did not have any idea of the proper way of naming a dragon, nor any way of finding out at the time," Lawrence said, feeling he had made a misstep.
No one had remarked on Temeraire's unusual name before, and only now that she had brought him to task for it did he guess that perhaps he had raised a sore point with her.
"I called him after a ship. The first Temeraire was captured from the French, and the one presently in service is a 98-gun three-decker, one of our finest line-of-battle ships."
When he had made this confession, she seemed to grow more easy, and said with more candour, "Oh, as you have said as much, I do not mind admitting that it was nearly the same with me. Lily was not properly expected to hatch for another 5 years at the earliest, and I had no notion of a name. When her egg hardened, they woke me in the middle of the night at Edinburgh Covert and flung me on a Winchester, and I barely managed to reach the baths before she broke the shell. I simply gaped when she invited me to give her a name, and I could not think of anything else."
"It is a charming name, and perfectly suits her, Catherine," Rankin said, joining them at the table. "Good morning, Lawrence. Have you seen the paper? Lord Pugh has finally managed to marry off his daughter. Ferrold must be desperately hard up."
This piece of gossip, concerning as it did people whom Harcourt did not know at all, left her outside the conversation. Before Lawrence could change the subject, however, she excused herself and slipped away from the table, and he lost the opportunity to further the acquaintance. The few days remaining in the week before the excursion passed swiftly. The training as yet was still more a matter of testing Temeraire's flying abilities and seeing how best he and Maximus could be worked into the formation centred on Lily. Celeritas had them fly endless circuits around the training valley, sometimes trying to minimize the number of wing beats, sometimes trying to maximize their speed, and always trying to keep them in line with one another. One memorable morning was spent almost entirely upside down, and Lawrence found himself dizzy and red-faced at the end of it. The stouter Berkeley was huffing as he staggered off Maximus's back after the final pass, and Lawrence leapt forward to ease him to the ground as his legs gave out from under him. Maximus hovered anxiously over Berkeley and rumbled in distress.
"Stop that moaning, Maximus! Nothing more ridiculous than a creature of your size behaving like a mother hen!"
Berkeley said as he fell into the chair that the servants had hurriedly brought.
"Ah, thank you,"
he said, taking the glass of brandy Lawrence offered him, and sipped at it while Lawrence loosened his neckcloth.
"I am sorry to have put you under such a strain," Celeritas said,
when Berkeley was no longer gasping and scarlet.
"Ordinarily these trials will be spread over half a month's time. Perhaps I am pressing on too quickly."
"Nonsense. I will be well in a trice," Berkeley said at once. "I know damned well we cannot spare a moment, Celeritas, so do not be holding us back on my account."
"Lawrence, why are matters so urgent?" Temeraire asked that evening after dinner, as they once again settled down together outside the courtyard walls to read. "Is there to be a great battle soon, and we are needed for it?"
Lawrence folded the book closed, keeping his place with a finger.
"No. I am sorry to disappoint you, but we are too raw to be sent by choice directly into a major action. Still, it is very likely that Lord Nelson will not be able to destroy the French fleet without the help of one of the long-wing formations presently stationed in England. Our duty will be to take their place, so they may go. That will indeed be a great battle, and though we will not participate in it directly, I assure you our part is by no means unimportant."
"No, though it does not sound very exciting," Temeraire said. "But perhaps France will invade us, and then we will have to fight?"
He sounded rather more hopeful than anything else.
"We must hope not," Lawrence said. "If Nelson destroys their fleet, it will pretty well put paid to any chance of Bonaparte's bringing his army across. Though I have heard he has something like 1,000 boats to carry his men, they are only transports, and the navy would sink them by the dozens if they tried to come across without the protection of the fleet."
Temeraire sighed and put his head down over his forelegs.
"Oh," he said.
Lawrence laughed and stroked his nose.
"How bloodthirsty you are," he said with amusement. "Do not fear. I promise you we will see enough action when your training is done. There is a great deal of skirmishing over the Channel, for one thing, and then we may be sent in support of a naval operation, or perhaps sent to harass the French shipping independently."
This heartened Temeraire greatly, and he turned his attention to the book with restored good humour. Friday they spent in an endurance trial, trying to see how long both dragons could stay aloft. The formation's slowest members would be the two Yellow Reapers, so both Temeraire and Maximus had to be kept to that slower pace for the test, and they went around and around the training valley in an endless circle, while above them the rest of the formation performed a drill under Celeritas's supervision. A steady rain blurred all the landscape below into a grey monotony, and made the task still more boring. Temeraire often turned his head to inquire a little plaintively how long he had been flying, and Lawrence was generally obliged to inform him that scarcely a quarter of an hour had passed since the last query. Lawrence at least could watch the formation wheeling and diving, their bright colours marked against the pale grey sky. Poor Temeraire had to keep his head straight and level to maintain the best flying posture. After perhaps 3 hours, Maximus began to fall off the pace, his great wings beating more slowly and his head drooping. Berkeley took him back in, and Temeraire was left all alone, still going around. The rest of the formation came spiralling down to land in the courtyard, and Lawrence saw the dragons nodding to Maximus, inclining their heads respectfully. At this distance he could not make out any words, but it was clear they were all conversing easily among themselves while their captains milled about, and Celeritas gathered them together to review their performance. Temeraire saw them as well, and sighed a little, though he said nothing. Lawrence leaned forward and stroked his neck, and silently vowed to bring him back the most elegant jewels he could find in the whole of Edinburgh, if he had to draw out half his capital to do so. Lawrence came out into the courtyard early the next morning to say farewell to Temeraire before his trip with Rankin. He stopped short as he emerged from the hall. Levadas was being put under gear by a small ground crew, with Rankin at his head reading a newspaper and paying little attention to the proceedings.
"Hello, Lawrence," the little dragon said to him happily. "Look, this is my captain. He has come, and we are flying to Edinburgh today."
"Have you been talking with him?" Rankin said to Lawrence, glancing up.
"I see you are not exaggerating, and that you do indeed enjoy dragon society. I hope you will not find yourself tiring of it."
"You will be taking Lawrence along with myself today. You must make an effort to show him a good pace," he told Levitas.
"Oh, I will, I promise,"
Levitas said at once, bobbing his head anxiously. Lawrence made some civil answer and walked quickly to Temeraire's side to cover his confusion. He did not know what to do. There was no possible way to avoid the journey now without being truly insulting, but he felt almost ill. Over the last few days he had seen more evidence than he liked of Levitas's unhappiness and neglect. The little dragon watched anxiously for a handler who did not come, and if he or his harness had been given more than a cursory wipe, it was because Lawrence had encouraged the cadets to see to him, and asked Hollin to continue attending to his harness. To find Rankin, the one responsible for such neglect, was bitterly disappointing. To see Levitas behaving with such civility and gratitude for the least cold attention was painful. Perceived through the lens of his neglect of his dragon, Rankin's remarks on dragons took on a character of disdain that could only be strange and unpleasant in an aviator, and his isolation from his fellow officers also, rather than an indication of nice taste. Every other aviator had introduced himself with his dragon's name ready to his lips. Rankin alone had considered his family name of more importance, and left Lawrence to find out only by accident that Levitas was assigned to him. But Lawrence had not seen through any of this, and now he found he had, in the most unguarded sort of way, encouraged the acquaintance of a man he could never respect. He petted Temeraire and made him some reassurances, meant mostly for his own comfort.
"Is anything wrong, Lawrence?"
Temeraire said, nosing at him gently with concern.
"You do not seem well."
"No, I am perfectly well, I assure you," he said, making an effort to sound normal. "You are quite certain you do not mind my going?" he asked, with a faint hope.
"Not at all. And you will be back by evening, will you not?" Temeraire asked. "Now that we have finished Duncan, I was hoping perhaps you could read me something more about mathematics. I thought it was very interesting how you explained that you could tell where you are when you have been sailing for a long time only through knowing the time and some equations."
Lawrence had been very glad to leave behind mathematics after having forced the basics of trigonometry into his head.
"Certainly, if you like," he said, trying to keep dismay out of his voice. "But I thought perhaps you would enjoy something about Chinese dragons."
"Oh, yes, that would be splendid, too. We could read that next," Temeraire said. "It is very nice how many books there are, indeed, and on so many subjects."
If it would give Temeraire something to think about and keep him from becoming distressed, Lawrence was prepared to go as far as to bring his Latin up to snuff and read him Principia Mathematica in the original. So he only sighed privately.
"Very well. Then I leave you in the hands of the ground crew. I see them coming now."
Hollin was leading the party. The young crewman had attended so well to Temeraire's harness and seen to Levitas with such goodwill that Lawrence had spoken of him to Celeritas and asked to have him assigned to lead Temeraire's ground crew. Lawrence was pleased to see the request had been granted. Because this step was evidently a promotion of some significance, there had been some uncertainty about the matter. He nodded to the young man.
"Mr. Hollin, will you be so good as to present me to these other men?" he asked.
When he had been given all their names and repeated them silently over to fix them in his memory, he deliberately met their eyes in turn and said firmly,
"I am sure Temeraire will give you no difficulty, but I trust you will make a point of consulting his comfort as you make the adjustments. Temeraire, please have no hesitation about informing these men if you notice the least discomfort or restriction upon your movement."
Levitas's case had provided him with evidence that some crewmen might neglect their assigned dragon's gear if a captain was not watchful, and indeed anything else was hardly to be expected. Though he had no fear of Hollins neglecting his work, Lawrence meant to put the other men on notice that he would not tolerate any such neglect where Temeraire was concerned. If such severity fixed his reputation as a hard captain, so be it. Perhaps in comparison with other aviators he was. He would not neglect what he considered his duty for the sake of being liked. A murmur of, "Very good," and "Right you are," came in response. He was able to ignore the raised eyebrows and exchanged glances. "Carry on, then," he said with a final nod, and turned away with no small reluctance to join Rankin. All his pleasure in the expedition was gone. It was distasteful in the extreme to stand by while Rankin snapped at Levitas and ordered him to hunch down uncomfortably for them to board. Lawrence climbed up as quickly as he could and did his best to sit where his weight would give Levitas the least difficulty. The flight was brief, at least. Levitas was very swift, and the ground rolled away at a tremendous pace. He was glad to find the speed of their passage made conversation nearly impossible, and he was able to give brief answers to the few remarks Rankin ventured to shout. They landed less than 2 hours after they had left, at the great walled covert which spread out beneath the watchful looming eye of Edinburgh Castle. "Stay here quietly. I do not want to hear that you have been pestering the crew when I return," Rankin said sharply to Levitas after dismounting. He threw the reins of his harness around a post as if Levitas were a horse to be tethered. "You can eat when we return to Loch Laggan."
"I do not want to bother them, and I can wait to eat, but I am a little thirsty," Levitas said in a small voice. "I tried to fly as fast as I could," he added.
"It was very fast indeed, Levitas, and I am grateful to you. Of course you must have something to drink," Lawrence said. This was as much as he could bear. "You there!" he called to the ground crewmen lounging around the edges of the clearing. None of them had stirred when Levitas had landed. "Bring a trough of clean water at once and see to his harness while you're about it." The men looked a little surprised, but they set to work under Lawrence's hard eye. Rankin did not make any objection, although as they climbed up the stairs away from the covert and onto the streets of the city, he said, "I see you are a little tender-hearted towards them. I am hardly surprised, as that is the common mode among aviators, but I must tell you that I find discipline answers far better than the sort of coddling more often seen. Levitas, for instance, must always be ready for a long and dangerous flight. It is good for him to be used to going without." Lawrence felt all the awkwardness of his situation. He was here as Rankin's guest, and he would have to fly back with the man in the evening. Nevertheless, he could not restrain himself from saying, "I will not deny having the warmest sentiments towards dragons as a whole. In my experience thus far, I have found them uniformly appealing and worthy of nothing but respect. However, I must disagree with you very strongly that providing ordinary and reasonable care in any way constitutes coddling, and I have always found that deprivation and hardship, when necessary, can be better endured by men who have not been subjected to them previously for no cause." "Oh, dragons are not men, you know. But I will not argue with you," Rankin said easily. Perversely, it made Lawrence even angrier. If Rankin had been willing to defend his philosophy, it could have been a sincere, if wrong-headed, position, but clearly it was not. Rankin was only consulting his own ease, and these remarks were merely excuses for the neglect he performed. Fortunately, they were at the crossroads, where their paths were to diverge. Lawrence did not have to endure Rankin's company any longer, as the man had to go on rounds to the military offices in the city. They had agreed to meet back at the covert before their departure, and he escaped gladly. He wandered around the city for the next hour without direction or purpose, solely to clear his mind and temper. There was no obvious way to ameliorate Levitas's situation, and Rankin was clearly inured to disapproval. Lawrence now recalled Berkeley's silence, Harcourt's evident discomfort, the avoidance of the other aviators in general, and Celeritas's disapproval. It was unpleasant to think that by showing such an evident partiality for Rankin's company, he had given himself the character of approving the man's behaviour. Here was something for which he had rightly earned the cold looks of the other officers. It was of no use to say he had not known. He ought to have known. Instead of putting himself to the trouble of learning the ways of his new comrades in arms, he had been happy enough to throw himself into the company of one they avoided and looked at askance. He could hardly excuse himself by saying he had not consulted or trusted their general judgment. He calmed himself only with difficulty. He could not easily undo the damage he had done in a few unthinking days, but he could and would alter his behaviour henceforth. By putting forth the dedication and effort that was only Temeraire's due in any case, he could prove that he neither approved nor intended to practice any sort of neglect. By courtesy and attention to those aviators with whom he would be training, like Berkeley and the other captains of the formation, he could show that he did not hold himself above his company. These small measures would take a great deal of time to repair his reputation, but they were all he could do. The best he could do was resolve upon them at once, and prepare to endure however long it would take. Having finally drawn himself from his self-recrimination, he now took his bearings and hurried on to the offices of the Royal Bank. His usual bankers were Drummond's in London, but on learning that he was to be stationed at Lochlagan, he had written to his prize agent to direct the funds from the capture of the Amateur here. As soon as he had given his name, he at once saw that the instructions had been received and obeyed, for he was instantly conducted to a private office and greeted with particular warmth. The banker, a Mr. Donaldson, was happy to inform him, on his inquiry, that the prize money for the Amateur had included a bounty for Temeraire equal to the value that would have been placed on an unhatched egg of the same breed.
"Not that a number could easily be settled upon, as I understand it, for we have no notion of what the French paid for it, but at length it was held equal to a regal copper egg in value, and I'm happy to say that your 2/8 share of the entire prize comes to nearly £14,000, he finished, and struck Lawrence dumb.
Having recovered over a glass of excellent brandy, Lawrence soon perceived the self-serving efforts of Admiral Croft behind this extraordinary assessment. But he hardly objected. After a brief discussion, which ended in his authorizing the bank to invest perhaps half of the money into the funds for him, he shook Mr. Donaldson's hand with enthusiasm, and took away a handful of banknotes and gold, along with a generously offered letter, which he might show to merchants to establish his credit. The news restored his spirits to some extent, and he soothed them further by purchasing a great many books, and examining several different pieces of valuable jewellery, and imagining Temeraire's happiness at receiving them both. He settled finally upon a broad pendant of platinum, almost like a breastplate, set with sapphires around a single enormous pearl. The piece was designed to fasten about the dragon's neck with a chain that could be extended as Temeraire grew. The price was enough to make him swallow, but he recklessly signed the check regardless, and then waited while a boy ran to certify the amount with the bank, so he could immediately bear away the well-wrapped piece, with some difficulty due to its weight. From there he went straight back to the covert, even though there was another hour to the appointed meeting time. Levitas was lying unattended in the same dusty landing ground, his tail curled around himself. He looked tired and lonely. There was a small herd of sheep kept penned in the covert. Lawrence ordered one killed and brought for him, then sat with the dragon and talked to him quietly, until Rankin returned. The flight back was a little slower than the one out, and Rankin spoke coldly to Levitas when they landed. Past the point of caring if it seemed rude, Lawrence interrupted with praise and patted Levitas. It was little enough, and he felt miserable to see the little dragon huddled silently in a corner of the courtyard after Rankin had gone inside. But aerial command had given Levitas to Rankin. Lawrence had no authority to correct the man who was senior to him. Temeraire's new harness was neatly assembled upon a couple of benches by the side of the courtyard, the broad neck brace marked with his name in silver rivets. Temeraire himself was sitting outside again, looking over the quiet lake valley that was gradually fading into shadow as the late afternoon sun sank in the west, his eyes thoughtful and a little sad. Lawrence went to his side at once, carrying the heavy packages. Temeraire's joy in the pendant was so great as to rescue Lawrence's mood as well as his own. The silver metal looked dazzling against his black hide, and once it was on he tilted the piece up with a forehand to look at the great pearl in enormous satisfaction, his pupils widening tremendously so he could better examine it.
"And I do so like pearls, Lawrence," he said, nuzzling at him gratefully. "It is very beautiful. But was it not dreadfully expensive?"
"It is worth every penny to see you looking so handsome," Lawrence said, meaning that it was worth every penny to see him so happy. "The prize money for the Amateur has come in, so I am well in pocket, my dear. Indeed, it is quite your due, you know, for the better part of it comes from the bounty for our having taken your egg from the French."
"Well, that was none of my doing, although I am very glad it happened," Temeraire said. I am sure I could not have liked any French captain half so much as you. Oh, Lawrence, I am so very happy, and none of the others have anything nearly so nice."
He cuddled himself around Lawrence with a deep sigh of satisfaction. Lawrence climbed into the crook of one foreleg and sat there, petting him, and enjoying his continued quiet gloating over the pendant. Of course, if the French ship had not been so delayed, and then captured, some French aviator would have had Temeraire by now. Lawrence had previously given little thought to what might have been. Likely the man was somewhere cursing his luck. The French certainly would have learned that the egg had been captured by now, even if they did not know that it had hatched an Imperial, or that Temeraire had been successfully harnessed. He looked up at his preening dragon and felt the rest of his sorrow and anxiety leave him. Whatever else happened, he could hardly complain of the turn fate had served him in comparison with that poor fellow.
"I have brought you some books as well," he said. "Shall I begin on Newton for you? I have found a translation of his book on the principles of mathematics, although I will warn you at once that I am wholly unlikely to be able to make sense of what I read for you. I am no great hand at mathematics beyond what my tutors got into my head for sailing."
"Please do," Temeraire said, looking away from his new treasure for a moment. "I am sure we will be able to puzzle it out together, whatever it is."
Chapter 7 Lawrence rose early the next morning and breakfasted alone, to have a little time before the training would begin. He had examined the new harness carefully last night, looking over each neat stitch and testing all the solid rings. Temeraire had also assured him that the new gear was very comfortable, and that the crewmen had been attentive to his wishes. He felt some gesture was due, and so, having made some calculations in his head, he now walked out to the workshops. Hollin was already up and working in his stall, and he stepped out at once on catching sight of Lawrence.
"Morning to you, sir. I hope there is nothing wrong with the harness," the young man asked. "No, on the contrary, I commend you and your colleagues highly," Lawrence said. "It looks splendid, and Temeraire tells me he is very happy in it. Thank you. Kindly tell the others for me that I will be having an additional half-crown for each man dispersed with their pay." "Why, that is very kind of you, sir," Hollin said, looking pleased but not terribly surprised. Lawrence was very glad to see his reaction. An extra ration of rum or grog was, of course, not a desirable reward to men who could buy liquor easily from the village below, and soldiers and aviators were paid better than sailors, so he had puzzled over an appropriate amount. He wanted to reward their diligence, but he did not want to seem as though he were trying to purchase the men's loyalty.
"I also wish to commend you personally," Lawrence added, more relaxed now. "Levitus's harness looks in much better order, and he seems more comfortable. I am obliged to you. I know it was not your duty."
"Oh, nothing to it," Hollin said, smiling broadly now. "The little fellow was made so happy I was right glad to have done it. I'll give him a look over now and again to make sure he's staying in good order. Seems to me he's a little lonely," he added.
Lawrence would never go so far as to criticize another officer to a crewman. He contented himself with saying merely,
"I think he was certainly grateful for the attention, and if you should have the time, I would be glad of it."
It was the last moment that he had time to spare concern for Levitas or anything beyond the tasks immediately before him. Celeritas had satisfied himself that he understood Temeraire's flying capabilities, and now that Temeraire had his fine new harness, their training began in earnest. From the beginning, Lawrence was staggering straight to bed after supper, and having to be woken by the servants at the first light of morning. He could barely muster any sort of conversation at the dinner table, and he spent every free moment either dozing with Temeraire in the sun or soaking in the heat of the baths. Celeritas was merciless and tireless both. There were countless repetitions of this wheeling turn or that pattern of swoops and dives, then flying short bombing runs at top speed, during which the bellmen hurled practice bombs down at targets on the valley floor. Long hours of gunnery practice until Temeraire could hear a full volley of 8 rifles go off behind his ears without so much as blinking. Crew manoeuvres and drills until he no longer twitched when he was clambered upon or his harness shifted. And to close every day's work, another long stretch of endurance training, sending him around and around until he had nearly doubled the amount of time he could spend aloft at his quickest pace. Even while Temeraire was sprawled panting in the training courtyard and getting his wind back, the training master had Lawrence practice moving about the harness both on Temeraire's back and upon rings hung over the cliff wall, to increase his skill at a task that other aviators had been doing from their earliest years in the service. It was not too unlike moving about the tops in a gale, if one imagined a ship moving at a pace of 30 miles in an hour, and turning completely sideways or upside down at any moment. His hands slipped free constantly during the first week, and without the paired carabiners he would have plummeted to his death a dozen times over. And as soon as they were released from the day's flight training, they were handed straight over to an old captain, Jolson, for drilling in aerial signalling. The flag and flare signals for communicating general instructions were much the same as in the Navy, and the most basic gave Lawrence no difficulty. But the need to coordinate quickly between dragons in mid-air made the usual technique of spelling out more unusual messages impractical. As a result, there was a vastly longer list of signals, some requiring as many as 6 flags, and all of these had to be beaten into their heads, for a captain could not rely solely upon his signal officer. A signal seen and acted upon even a moment more quickly might make all the difference in the world, so both captain and dragon must know them all. The signal officer was merely a safeguard, and his duty more to send signals for Lawrence and call his attention to new signals in battle than to be the sole source of translation. To Lawrence's embarrassment, Temeraire proved quicker to learn the signals than himself. Even Jolson was more than a little taken aback at the dragon's proficiency.
"And he is old to be learning them besides," he told Lawrence. "Usually we start them on the flags the very day after hatching. I did not like to say so before, not to be discouraging, but I expected him to have a good deal of trouble. If a dragonet is a bit slow and does not learn all the signals by the end of their 5th or 6th week, he struggles with the last ones sadly, but here Temeraire is already older than that and learning them as though he were fresh from the egg."
But though Temeraire had no exceptional difficulty, the effort of memorization and repetition was still as tiring as their more physical duties. 5 weeks of rigorous work passed this way, without even a break on Sundays. They progressed together with Maximus and Berkeley through the increasingly complex manoeuvres that had to be learned before they could join the formation, and all the time the dragons were growing enormously. By the end of this period, Maximus had almost reached his full adult size, and Temeraire was scarcely one man's height less in the shoulder, though much leaner, and his growth was now mostly in bulk, and in his wings rather than his height. He was beautifully proportionate throughout. His tail was long and very graceful, his wings fit elegantly against his body, and looked precisely the right size when fanned out. His colours had intensified, the black hide turning hard and glossy, save for the soft nose, and the blue and pale grey markings on the edges of his wings spreading and becoming opalescent. To Lawrence's partial eye, he was the handsomest dragon in the entire covert, even without the great shining pearl blazoned upon his chest. The constant occupation, along with the rapid growth, had at least temporarily eased Temeraire's unhappiness. It was now larger than any of the other dragons but Maximus. Even Lily was shorter than he was, though her wingspan was still greater. Though Temeraire did not push himself forward and was not given precedence by the feeders, Lawrence saw on the occasions when he observed that most of the other dragons did unconsciously give way to him at feeding times, and if Temeraire did not come to be friendly with any of them, he seemed too busy to pay it mind, much as Lawrence himself with the other aviators. For the most part, they were company for each other. They were rarely apart except while eating or sleeping, and Lawrence honestly felt little need of other society. Indeed, he was glad enough for the excuse, which enabled him to avoid Rankin's company almost entirely. By answering with reserve on all occasions when he was not able to do so, he felt he had at least halted the progress of their acquaintance, if not partly undone it. His and Temeraire's acquaintance with Maximus and Berkeley progressed, at least, which kept them from being wholly isolated from their fellows, though Temeraire continued to prefer sleeping outside on the grounds, rather than in the courtyard with the other dragons. They had already been assigned Temeraire's ground crew. Besides Hollin as the head, Pratt and Bell, armourer and leather worker respectively, formed the corps, along with the gunner Calloway. Many dragons had no more, but as Temeraire continued to grow, the masters were somewhat grudgingly granted assistance, first one, and then a second for each, until Temeraire's complement was only a few men short of Maximus's. The harness master's name was Fellows. He was a silent but dependable man with some 10 years of experience in his line, and more to the point, skilful at coaxing additional men out of the corps. He managed to get Lawrence 8 harness men. They were badly wanted, as Lawrence persisted in having Temeraire out of the gear whenever possible. He needed the full harness, put on and off, far more often than most dragons. Save for these hands, the rest of Temeraire's crew would be composed entirely of officers, gentlemen-born, and even the hands were the equivalent of warrant officers or their mates. It was strange to Lawrence, used to commanding 10 raw landsmen to every able seaman. There was none of the boatswain's brutal discipline here. Such men could not be struck or started, and the worst punishment was to turn a man off. Lawrence could not deny he liked it better, though he felt unhappily disloyal at admitting of any fault in the navy, even to himself. Nor was there any fault to be found in the calibre of his officers, as he had imagined, at least not more than in his prior experience. Half of his riflemen were completely raw midwing men who had barely yet learned which end of a gun to hold. However, they seemed willing enough and were improving quickly. Collins was over-eager but had a good eye, and if Donald and Dunn still had some difficulty in finding the target, they were at least quick in reloading. Their lieutenant, Riggs, was somewhat unfortunate, hasty-tempered and excitable, given to bellowing at small mistakes. He was himself a fine shot and knew his work, but Lawrence would have preferred a steadier man to guide the others. But he did not have free choice of men. Riggs had seniority and had served with distinction, so at least merited his position, which made him superior to several officers with whom Lawrence had been forced to serve in the navy. The permanent aerial crew, the topmen and bellmen responsible for managing Temeraire's equipage during flight, and the senior officers and lookouts, were not yet settled. Most of the currently assigned junior officers at the covert would first be given a chance to take positions upon Temeraire during the course of his training, before final assignment was made. Celeritas had explained that this was a common technique used to ensure that the aviators practiced handling as many types of dragon as possible, as the techniques varied greatly depending on the breed. Martin had done well in his stint, and Lawrence had hoped that he might be able to get the young midwing man a permanent berth. Several other promising young men had also recommended themselves to him. The only matter of real concern to him was the question of his first lieutenant. He had been disappointed in the first 3 candidates assigned him. All were adequate, but none of them struck him as gifted, and he was particular for Temeraire's sake, even if he would not have been for his own. More unpleasantly, Granby had just been assigned in his turn, and though the lieutenant was executing his duties in perfect order, he was always addressing Lawrence as Sir, and pointedly making his obedience at every turn. It was an obvious contrast with the behaviour of the other officers, and made them all uneasy. Lawrence could not help but think, with regret, of Tom Riley. That aside, he was satisfied, though increasingly eager to be done with manoeuvre drills. Fortunately, Celeritas had pronounced Temeraire and Maximus almost ready to join the formation. There were only the last complex manoeuvres to be mastered, those flown entirely upside down. The 2 dragons were in the midst of practising these in a clear morning, when Temeraire remarked to Lawrence, "That is Volley over there, coming towards us," and Lawrence lifted his head to see a small grey speck winging its way rapidly to the covert. Volley sailed directly into the valley and landed in the training courtyard, a violation of the covert rules when a practice was in session, and Captain James leapt off his dragon's back to talk to Celeritas. Interested, Temeraire righted himself and stopped in mid-air to watch, tumbling about all the crew except Lawrence, who was by now used to the manoeuvre. Maximus kept going a little longer until he noticed that he was alone, then turned and flew back, despite Berkeley's roared protests.
"What do you suppose it is?"
Maximus asked in his rumbling voice. Unable to hover himself, he was obliged to fly in circles.
"Listen, you great lummox! If it is any of your affair, you will be told," Berkeley said. "Will you get back to manoeuvres?"
"I do not know. Perhaps we could ask Volley," Temeraire said. "And there is no sense in our doing manoeuvres any more. We already know all of these," he added.
He sounded so mulish that Lawrence was startled. He leaned forward, frowning, but before he could speak, Celeritas called them in, urgently.
"There has been an air battle in the North Sea off Aberdeen," he said with no preliminaries, when they had scarcely landed. Several dragons of the covert outside Edinburgh responded to distress signals from the city, though they drove off the French attack. Victoriatus was wounded. He is very weak and having difficulty staying in the air. The two of you are large enough to help support him and bring him in more quickly. Volatilus and Captain James will lead you. Go at once!
Volley took the lead and flew off at a tearing speed, showing them his heels easily. He kept only just within the limits of their sight. Maximus could not keep up, even with Temeraire, however, so with flag signals and some hasty shouting back and forth through the speaking trumpets, Berkeley and Lawrence agreed that Temeraire would go on ahead, and his crew would send up regular flares to mark the direction for Maximus. The arrangements made, Temeraire pulled away very rapidly, going, Lawrence thought, a little too fast. The distance was not very great as the dragon flew. Aberdeen was some 120 miles distant, and the other dragons would be coming towards them, closing the distance from the other side. Still, they would need to be able to fly the same distance again to bring Victoriatus in. And even though they would be flying over land, not ocean, they could not land and rest with the wounded dragon leaning upon them. There would be no getting him off the ground again. Some moderation of speed would be necessary. Lawrence glanced down at the chronometer strapped down to Temeraire's harness, waited for the minute hand to shift, then counted wing beats. 25 knots. Too high.
"Gently, if you please, Temeraire," he called. "We have a good deal of work ahead of us."
"I am not tired at all," Temeraire said, but he slowed regardless.
Lawrence made his new speed as 15 knots, a good pace, and one that Temeraire could sustain almost indefinitely.
"Pass the word for Mr. Granby," Lawrence said.
Shortly, the lieutenant clambered forward to Lawrence's position at the base of Temeraire's neck, swapping carabiners quickly to move himself along.
"What is your estimate of the best rate the injured dragon can be maintaining?"
Lawrence asked him. For once, Granby did not respond with cold formality, but thoughtfully. All the aviators had immediately become very grave on the moment of hearing of the injured dragon.
"Victoriatus is a Parnassian," he said. "A large midweight, heavier than a reaper. They don't have heavy combat dragons at Edinburgh, so the others supporting him must be midweights. They cannot be making more than 12 miles per hour.
Lawrence paused to convert between knots and miles, then nodded. Temeraire was going almost twice as quickly then. Taking into account Volley's speed in bringing the message, they had perhaps 3 hours before they would need to start looking for the other party.
"Very good. We may as well use the time, have the topmen and bellmen exchange places for practice, and then I think we will try some gunnery."
He felt quite calm and settled himself, but he could feel Temeraire's excitement transmitting itself through a faint twitching along the back of his neck. Of course, this was Temeraire's first action of any sort, and Lawrence stroked the twitching ridge soothingly. He swapped around his carabiners and turned to observe the manoeuvres he had ordered. In sequence, a topman climbed down to the belly rigging at the same time as a bellman climbed up to the back on the other side, the two weights balancing each other. As the man who had just climbed up locked himself into place, he tugged on the signal strap, coloured in alternating sections of black and white, and pulled it ahead a section. In a moment it advanced again, indicating that the man below had locked himself in as well. All went smoothly. Temeraire was presently carrying 3 topmen and 3 bellmen. And the exchange took less than 5 minutes, all told.
"Mr. Allen,"
Lawrence said sharply, calling one of the lookouts to order. An older cadet, soon to be made ensign, neglecting his duty to watch the other men at their work.
"Can you tell me what is in the upper northwest? No, do not turn round and look. You must be able to answer that question the moment it is asked. I will speak with your instructor. Mind your work now."
The riflemen took up their positions, and Lawrence nodded to Granby to give the order. The topmen began throwing out the flat ceramic discs used for targeting, and the riflemen took turns attempting to shoot them out of the air as they flew past. Lawrence watched and frowned.
"Mr. Granby, Mr. Riggs, I make 12 targets out of 20, you concur? Gentlemen, I hope I need not say that this will not do against French sharpshooters. Let us begin again at a slower rate. Precision first, speed second, Mr. Collins, so pray do not be so hasty."
He kept them at it for a full hour, then had the hands go through the complicated harness adjustments for storm flying. Afterwards he himself went down below and observed the men stationed below while they reverted to fair-weather rigging. They did not have the tents aboard, so he could not have them practice going to quarters and breaking down full gear, but they did well enough at the rigging changes, and he thought they would have done well even with the additional equipment. Temeraire occasionally glanced around to watch throughout these manoeuvres, his eyes bright. But for the most part he was intent on his flying, rising and falling in the air to catch the best currents, driving himself forward with great, steady beats, each thrust fully carried through. Lawrence laid his hand upon the long, ropey muscles of Temeraire's neck, feeling them move smoothly as though oiled beneath the skin, and was not tempted to distract him with conversation. There was no need. He knew, without speaking, that Temeraire shared his satisfaction at putting their joint training to real purpose at last. Lawrence had not wholly realized his own sense of quiet frustration to have been in some sense demoted from a serving officer to a schoolboy until he now found himself again engaged in active duty. The 3 hours were nearly up by the chronometer, and it was time to begin preparing to give support to the injured dragon. Maximus was perhaps half an hour behind them, and Temeraire would have to carry Victoriatus alone until the regal copper caught up.
"Mr. Granby,"
Lawrence said, as he latched himself back into his normal position at the base of the neck.
"Let us clear the back. All the men below, save for the signal ensign and the forward lookouts."
"Very good, sir,"
Granby said, nodding, and turned at once to arrange it. Lawrence watched him work with mingled satisfaction and irritation. For the first time in the past week, Granby had been going about his duties without that air of stiff resentment, and Lawrence could easily perceive the effects. The speed of nearly every operation improved. Myriad small defects in harness placement and crew positioning, previously invisible to his own inexperienced eye, now corrected. The atmosphere among the men more relaxed. All the many ways in which an excellent first lieutenant could improve the life of a crew, and Granby was now proven capable of them all. But that only made his earlier attitude more regrettable. Volatilis turned and came flying back towards them only shortly after they had cleared the top. James pulled him about and cupped his hands around his mouth to call to Lawrence.
"I've sighted them! 2 points to the north and 12 degrees down! You'll need to drop to come up under them, for I don't think he can get any more elevation."
He signalled the numbers with his hand gestures as he spoke.
"Very good!"
Lawrence called back through his speaking trumpet, and had the signal ensign wave a confirmation with flags. Temeraire was large enough now that Volley could not get so close as to make verbal communication certain. Temeraire stooped into a dive at his quick signal, and very soon Lawrence saw a speck on the horizon rapidly enlarge into the group of dragons. Victoriatus was instantly identifiable. He was larger by half than either of the 2 yellow reapers struggling to keep him aloft. Though the injuries were already under thick bandages applied by his crew, blood had seeped through, showing the slashing marks where the dragon had evidently taken blows from the enemy beasts. The Parnassian's own claws were unusually large, and stained with blood as well, his jaws also. The smaller dragons below looked crowded, and there was no one aboard the injured dragon but his captain and perhaps half a dozen men.
"Signal the 2 supporters! Prepare to stand aside,"
Lawrence said. The young signal ensign waved the coloured flags in rapid sequence, and a prompt acknowledgement came back. Temeraire had already flown around the group and positioned himself properly. He was just below, and to the back of the second supporting dragon.
"Temeraire, are you quite ready?"
Lawrence called. They had practised this manoeuvre in training, but it would be unusually difficult to carry out here. The injured dragon was barely beating his wings, and his eyes were half shut with pain and exhaustion. The 2 supporters were clearly worn out themselves. They would have to drop out of the way smoothly, and Temeraire dart in very quickly to avoid having Victoriatus collapse into a deadly plummet that would be impossible to arrest.
"Yes, please let us hurry. They look so very tired,"
Temeraire said, glancing back. His muscles were tightly gathered. They had matched the others' pace, and nothing more could be gained by waiting.
"Signal! Exchange positions on lead dragon's mark,"
Lawrence said. The flags waved, the acknowledgement came, then on both sides of the foremost of the 2 supporting dragons the red flags went out, and then were swapped for the green. The rear dragon dropped and peeled aside swiftly as Temeraire lunged, but the forward dragon went a little too slowly, his wings stuttering, and Victoriatus began to tilt forward as the reaper tried to descend away and make room.
"Dive, damn you!
"Dive!"
Lawrence roared at the top of his lungs. The smaller dragon's lashing tail was dangerously near Temeraire's head, and they could not move into place. The Reaper gave up the manoeuvre and simply folded his wings. He dropped out of the way like a stone.
"Temeraire, you must get him up a little so you can come forward!"
Lawrence shouted again, crouched low against the neck. Victoriatus's hind quarters had settled over Temeraire's shoulders instead of further back, and the great belly was less than 3 feet overhead, barely kept up by the injured dragon's waning strength. Temeraire showed with a bob of his head that he had heard and understood. He beat up rapidly at an angle, pushing the slumping Parnassian back up higher through sheer strength, then snapped his wings closed. A brief, sickening drop, then his wings fanned out again. With a single great thrust, Temeraire had himself properly positioned, and Victoriatus came heavily down upon them again. Lawrence had a moment of relief. Then Temeraire cried out in pain. He turned and saw in horror that in his confusion and agony Victoriatus was scrabbling at Temeraire, and the great claws had raked Temeraire's shoulder and side. Above, muffled, he heard the other captain shouting. Victoriatus stopped, but Temeraire was already bleeding, and straps of the harness were hanging loose and flapping in the wind. They were losing elevation rapidly. Temeraire was struggling to keep flying under the other dragon's weight. Lawrence fought with his carabiners, yelling at the signal ensign to let the men below know. The boy scrambled part way down the neck strap, waving the white and red flag wildly. In a moment, Lawrence gratefully saw Granby climbing up with two other men to bandage the wounds, reaching the gashes more quickly than he could. He stroked Temeraire, called reassurance to him in a voice that struggled not to break. Temeraire did not spare the effort to turn and reply, but bravely kept beating his wings, though his head was drooping with the strain.
"Not deep!"
Granby shouted, from where they worked to pad the gashes, and Lawrence could breathe and think clearly again. The harness was shifting upon Temeraire's back. Aside from a great deal of lesser rigging, the main shoulder strap had been nearly cut through, saved only by the wires that ran through it. But the leather was parting, and as soon as it went, the wires would break under the strain of all the men and gear currently riding below.
"All of you, take off your harnesses and pass them to me,"
Lawrence said to the signal ensign and the lookouts. The three boys were the only ones left above, besides him.
"Take a good grip on the main harness and get your arms or legs tucked beneath."
The leather of the personal harnesses was thick, solidly stitched, well oiled. The carabiners were solid steel, not quite as strong as the main harness, but nearly so. He slung the three harnesses over his arm and clambered along the back strap to the broader part of the shoulders. Granby and the two midwing men were still working on the injuries to Temeraire's side. They spared him a puzzled look, and Lawrence realized they could not see the nearly severed shoulder band. It was hidden from their view by Temeraire's foreleg. There was no time to call them forward to help. In any case, the band was rapidly beginning to give way. He could not come at it normally. If he tried to put his weight on any of the rings along the shoulder band, it would certainly break at once. Working as quickly as he could under the roaring pressure of the wind, he hooked two of the harnesses together by their carabiners, then looped them around the back strap.
"Temeraire, stay as level as you can!"
he shouted. Then, clinging to the ends of the harnesses, he unlocked his own carabiners and climbed carefully out onto the shoulder, held by nothing more secure than his grip on the leather. Granby was shouting something at him. The wind was tearing it away, and he could not make out the words. Lawrence tried to keep his eyes fixed on the straps. The ground below was the beautiful, fresh green of early spring, strangely calm and pastoral. They were low enough that he could see white dots of sheep. He was in arm's reach now. With a hand that shook slightly, he latched the first carabiner of the third loose harness onto the ring just above the cut, and the second onto the ring just below. He pulled on the straps, throwing his weight against them as much as he dared. His arms ached and trembled as if with high fever. Inch by inch, he drew the small harness tighter, until at last the portion between the carabiners was the same size as the cut portion of the band, and was taking much of its weight. The leather stopped fraying away. He looked up. Granby was slowly climbing towards him, snapping onto rings as he came. Now that the harness was in place, the strain was not an immediate danger, so Lawrence did not wave him off, but only shouted,
"Call up Mr. Fellows!"
the harness master, and pointed to the spot. Granby's eyes widened as he came over the foreleg and saw the broken strap. As Granby turned to signal below for help, bright sunlight abruptly fell full on his face. Victoriatus was shuddering above them, wings convulsing, and the Parnassian's chest came heavily down on Temeraire's back. Temeraire staggered in mid-air, one shoulder dipping under the blow, and Lawrence was sliding along the linked harness straps, wet palms giving him no purchase. The green world was spinning beneath him, and his hands were already tired and slick with sweat. His grip was failing.
"Lawrence, hold on!" Temeraire called,
head turned to look back at him. His muscles and wing joints were shifting as he prepared to snatch Lawrence out of the air.
"You must not let him fall!"
Lawrence shouted, horrified. Temeraire could not try to catch him except by tipping Victoriatus off his back and sending the Parnassian to his death.
"Temeraire! You must not!"
"Lawrence!"
Temeraire cried again, his claws flexing. His eyes were wide and distressed, and his head waved back and forth in denial. Lawrence could see he did not mean to obey. He struggled to keep hold of the leather straps, to try and climb up. If he fell, it was not only his own life which would be forfeit, but the injured dragon and all his crew still aboard. Granby was there suddenly, seizing Lawrence's harness in both his hands.
"Lock on to me!"
he shouted. Lawrence saw at once what he meant. With one hand still clinging to the linked harnesses, he locked his loose carabiners onto the rings of Granby's harness, then transferred his grip to Granby's chest straps. Then the midwing men reached them. All at once there were many strong hands grabbing at them, drawing Lawrence and Granby back up together to the main harness, and they held Lawrence in place while he locked his carabiners back onto the proper rings. He could scarcely breathe yet, but he seized his speaking trumpet and called urgently,
"All is well!"
His voice was hardly audible. He pulled in a deep breath and tried again, more clearly this time.
"I am fine, Temeraire. Only keep flying!"
The tense muscles beneath them unwound slowly, and Temeraire beat up again, regaining a little of the elevation they had lost. The whole process had lasted perhaps 15 minutes. He was shaking, as if he had been on deck throughout a 3-day gale, and his heart was thundering in his breast. Granby and the midwing men looked scarcely more composed.
"Well done, gentlemen,"
Lawrence said to them, as soon as he trusted his voice to remain steady.
"Let us give Mr. Fellows room to work. Mr. Granby, be so good as to send someone up to Victoriatus's captain and see what assistance we can provide. We must take what precautions we can to keep him from further starts."
They gaped at him a moment. Granby was the first to recover his wits and began issuing orders. By the time Lawrence had made his way, very cautiously, back to his post at the base of Temeraire's neck, the midwing men were wrapping Victoriatus's claws with bandages to prevent him from scratching Temeraire again, and Maximus was coming into sight in the distance, hurrying to their assistance. The rest of the flight was relatively uneventful, if the effort involved in supporting a nearly unconscious dragon through the air were ever to be considered ordinary. As soon as they landed Victoriatus safely in the courtyard, the surgeons came hurrying to see to both him and Temeraire. To Lawrence's great relief, the cuts indeed proved quite shallow. They were cleaned and inspected, pronounced minor, and a loose pad placed over them to keep the torn hide from being irritated. Then Temeraire was set loose, and Lawrence told to let him sleep and eat as much as he liked for a week. It was not the most pleasant way to win a few days of liberty, but the respite was infinitely welcome. Lawrence immediately walked Temeraire to an open clearing near the covert, not wanting to strain him by another leap aloft. Though the clearing was upon the mountain, it was relatively level and covered in soft green grass. It faced south, and the sun came into it nearly the entire day. There the two of them slept together from that afternoon until late in the next, Lawrence stretched out upon Temeraire's warm back, until hunger woke them both.
"I feel much better. I am sure I can hunt quite normally," Temeraire said.
Lawrence would not hear of it. He walked back up to the workshops and roused the ground crew instead. Very shortly they had driven a small group of cattle up from the pens and slaughtered them. Temeraire devoured every last scrap and fell directly back to sleep. Lawrence, a little diffidently, asked Hollin to arrange for the servants to bring him some food. It was enough, like asking the man for personal service, to make Lawrence uncomfortable, but he was reluctant to leave Temeraire. Hollin took no offence, but when he returned, Lieutenant Granby was with him, along with Riggs and a couple of the other lieutenants.
"You should go and have something hot to eat and a bath, and then sleep in your own bed," Granby said quietly, having waved the others off a little distance.
You are all over blood, and it is not warm enough yet for you to sleep outside without risk to your health. I and the other officers will take it in turns to stay with him. We will fetch you at once if he wakes, or if any change should occur." Lawrence blinked and looked down at himself. He had not even noticed that his clothes were spattered and streaked with the near black of dragon blood. He ran a hand over his unshaven face. He was clearly presenting a rather horrible picture to the world. He looked up at Temeraire. The dragon was completely unaware of his surroundings, sides rising and falling with a low, steady rumble.
"I dare say you are right," he said. "Very well. And thank you," he added.
Granby nodded, and with a last look up at the sleeping Temeraire, Lawrence took himself back to the castle. Now that it had been brought to mind, the sensation of dirt and sweat was unpleasant upon his skin. He had gotten soft, with the luxury of daily bathing at hand. He stopped by his room only long enough to exchange his stained clothes for fresh, and went straight to the baths. It was shortly after dinner, and many of the officers had a habit of bathing at this hour. After Lawrence had taken a quick plunge into the pool, he found the sweat room very crowded. But as he came in, several fellows made room for him. He gladly took the opened place, and returned the nods of greeting around the room before he laid himself down. He was so tired that it only occurred to him after his eyes were closed in the blissful heat that the attention had been unusual and marked. He almost sat up again with surprise.
"Well flown, very well flown, Captain,"
Celeritas told him that evening, approvingly, when he belatedly came to report.
"No, you need not apologize for being tardy. Lieutenant Granby has given me a preliminary account, and with Captain Berkeley's report I know well enough what happened. We prefer a captain to be more concerned for his dragon than for our bureaucracy. I trust Temeraire is doing well."
"Thank you, sir, yes," Lawrence said gratefully.
"The surgeons have told me there is no cause for alarm, and he says he is quite comfortable. Have you any duties for me during his recovery?"
"Nothing other than to keep him occupied, which you may find enough of a challenge," Celeritas said, with the snort that passed for a chuckle with him. "Well, that is not quite true. I do have one task for you. Once Temeraire is recovered, you and Maximus will be joining Lily's formation straight away. We have had nothing but bad news from the war, and the latest is worse. Villeneuve and his fleet have slipped out of Toulon under cover of an aerial raid against Nelson's fleet. We have lost track of them. Under the circumstances, and given this lost week, we cannot wait any longer. Therefore it is time to assign your flight crew, and I would like your requests. Consider the men who have served with you these last weeks, and we will discuss the matter tomorrow."
Lawrence walked slowly back out to the clearing after this, deep in thought. He had begged a tent from the ground crews and brought along a blanket. He thought he would be quite comfortable once he had pitched it by Temeraire's side, and he liked the idea better than spending the whole night away. He found Temeraire still sleeping peacefully, the flesh around the bandaged area only ordinarily warm to the touch. Having satisfied himself on this point, Lawrence said,
"A word with you, Mr. Granby,"
and led the lieutenant some short distance away.
"Celeritas has asked me to name my officers," he said,
looking steadily at Granby. The young man flushed and looked down. Lawrence continued,
"I will not put you in the position of refusing a post. I do not know what that means in the corps, but I know in the navy it would be a serious mark against you. If you would have the least objection, speak frankly. That will be an end to the matter."
"Sir," Granby began, then shut his mouth abruptly, looking mortified. He had used the term so often in veiled insolence. He started over again.
"Captain, I am well aware I have done little enough to deserve such consideration. I can only say that if you are willing to overlook what my past behaviour has been, I would be very glad of the opportunity."
This speech was a little stilted in his mouth, as if he had tried to rehearse it. Lawrence nodded, satisfied. His decision had been a near thing. If it had not been for Temeraire's sake, he was not sure he could have borne to thus expose himself to a man who had behaved disrespectfully towards him, despite Granby's recent heroics. But Granby was so clearly the best of the lot that Lawrence had decided to take the risk. He was well pleased with the reply. It was fair enough and respectful, even if awkwardly delivered.
"Very good," he said simply.
They had just begun walking back when Granby suddenly said, "Oh, damn it, I may not be able to word it properly, but I cannot just leave things at that. I have to tell you how very sorry I am. I know I have been playing the scrub." Lawrence was surprised by his frankness, but not displeased, and he could never have refused an apology offered with so much sincerity and feeling as was obvious in Granby's tone. "I am very happy to accept your apology," he said, quietly but with real warmth. "For my part, all is forgotten, I assure you, and I hope that henceforth we may be better comrades than we have been." They stopped and shook hands. Granby looked both relieved and happy, and when Lawrence tentatively inquired for his recommendations for other officers, he answered with great enthusiasm as they made their way back towards Temeraire's side.
Chapter 8. Even before the pad of bandages had come off, Temeraire began to make plaintive noises about wanting to be bathed again. By the end of the week, the cuts were scabbed over and healing, and the surgeons gave grudging approval. Having rounded up what he already thought of as his cadets, Lawrence came out to the courtyard to take the waiting Temeraire down, and found him talking with a female longwing whose formation they would be joining.
"Does it hurt when you spray?" Temeraire was asking inquisitively.
Lawrence could see that Temeraire was inspecting the pitted bone spurs on either side of her jaw, evidently where the acid was ejected.
"No, I do not feel it in the least," Lily answered. "The spray will only come out if I am pointing my head down, so I do not splash myself either, although of course you all must be careful to avoid it when we are in formation."
The enormous wings were folded against her back, looking brown with the translucent folds of blue and orange overlapping each other. Only the black and white edges stood out against her sides. Her eyes were slit, pupilled like Temeraire's, but orange-yellow, and the exposed bone spurs showing on either side of her jaw gave her a very savage appearance. But she stood with perfect patience while her ground crew scrambled over her, polishing and cleaning every scrap of harness with great attention. Captain Harcourt was walking back and forth around her and inspecting the work. Lily looked down at Lawrence as he came to Temeraire's side. Her alarming eyes gave her stare a baleful quality, although she was only curious.
"Are you Temeraire's captain? Catherine, shall we not go to the lake with them? I am not sure I want to go in the water, but I would like to see."
"Go to the lake?" Captain Harcourt was drawn from her inspection of the harness by the suggestion, and she stared at Lawrence in open astonishment. "Yes, I'm taking Temeraire to bathe," Lawrence said firmly. "Mr. Holland, let us have the light harness, if you please, and see if we cannot rig it to keep the straps well away from these cuts.